Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, my name is Richard Curtis, and I'm going to talk about the film I made, the film I wish I'd made, and the film I am making.
Rom-com king, Richard Curtis, the man responsible for so many films that we know and love, from Four Weddings and a Funeral, Notting Hill, Love Actually, the Bridget Jones films, the latest one. It's something very different, though. It's a young man going through an existential crisis after a cataclysmic global event, a film about...
that sounds exciting.
...imposter syndrome. It's another rom-com, really, isn't it? We'll talk about Yesterday a little bit later. Richard, when you grew up, were you a big fan of rom-coms, or are they just films that you think come naturally as a filmmaker?
I think there's a misunderstanding about the rom-com title. That's the thing. When I wrote Four Weddings, I definitely thought I was doing something different to that. I was trying to write a film like Breaking Away, Gregory's Girl, Rita Sue and Bob Too, Dinah. In other words, these were sort of semi-autobiographical young man's films in which necessarily love was part of it. So I think those were the things that I loved, as it were, not a more formulaic romantic thing, which it turned out, or eventually I was told, is what I'd written. But the idea was to just look at life and my life, and, you know, at that age I was pretty keen on the idea of finding love, or if I couldn't do that, at least a girlfriend. I don't mind formulas being used by people, obviously, who, you know, for whom love is there.
Would you dispute your films are rom-coms, then?
No. There's actually quite a sort of... I see a line through them, in that Four Weddings was literally by mistake, as it were. And then I thought, oh, I know what I'm doing here. And Notting Hill, because I had this idea, which was higher concept, the very famous girl, I sort of thought, oh, I know how to do this now. So as it were, that was... I would say that was the one that I wrote that really was quite close to a rom-com. And then Love Actually was my... I had other ideas, so I thought I'll just do 10 of them and squeeze them into a film, like sort of Shortcuts or Smoke or some of these movies that I really liked. Said, I wonder if you can do that. And but what happened is then I started being tempted to put in things that were to do with other kinds of love, brothers, sisters, fathers, all that kind of stuff. And then after that, I've sort of kept my foot in the romantic camp and sort of done half the films about other things, I think.
But it is love, isn't it, that is the recurring, it's the touchstone of your films.
Yeah, love verging upon love of friends and love of family. I mean, in some ways, I wish I'd focused on those a tiny bit more, but I have done a certain amount.
And when you first started watching films, were they the sort of films that interested you? Or do you think this is... you're just tapping into something which is...
No, that's a very good question. And I definitely enjoyed, you know, getting into my sort of, when I hit 20, I was definitely enjoying Ghost and Pretty Woman, perhaps more than some of my friends. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that I wasn't enjoying, you know, Beverly Hills Cop, which I adored, and Jaws, and you know, the guns of Navarone as much as I should have done. So I wouldn't have, if you'd said to me at 20, what are you going to end up writing? I would not have said, oh, well, the only thing I'm interested in movies is this. I wasn't loitering in my room looking at, you know, the Philadelphia Story. I was a pretty normal cinema goer.
But you weren't the sort of filmmaker either that was quoting from Fellini films or Coppola or...
No, never, very much on the populist front. Even though, I mean, again, there are some of those people's films I've seen and some of them I like. I mean, there are some I specifically don't like.
Did you, when you were a young man, when you were a kid, did you imagine that you would make films? Did you have a kind of a filmic imagination?
No, I didn't. I mean, I've always been lucky in being most obsessed by music, in which I have no talent. So that was fantastic. So I could just dive into a pool without ever thinking I have to contribute to this.
Do you play at all?
No.
I tried the piano, I tried the trumpet,
I tried everything.
So you don't play that?
No, fortunately, Emma, the mum of all my kids, does, and one, two, three of them have inherited from her some musical skills, which is great. But I was just, I couldn't play an instrument. And I just think I like movies as much as everyone else. I mean, I'm definitely not one of those. My friend Paul Greengrass gave a speech the other day saying in order to be a great movie director, you had to have had an unhappy or complicated childhood, in which case, you know, I'm screwed. Because I didn't.
So, the film I made, let's start with that one. Is there an obvious choice?
I'm actually going to do Love Actually, I think, which may not have been what I said I was going to do, and that's just because I did direct it, and it's quite an interesting thing to talk about. That was the first film I directed, and the extra complexities that followed upon that.
Do you feel
decision.
More proprietorial about no. that one than Four
no.
Weddings?
No, I don't. I feel because of the fact that I've been allowed by the directors I work with to be there every minute of casting, every minute of shooting, and quite a lot of the editing, I feel sort of equally about them. In fact, I feel slightly more lonely about Love Actually because I had to do it slightly more on my own.
Was that when you took on that film and you'd had the big success with Four Weddings and Notting Hill even more so, did you think, I'm on a roll here, I need to stay on this track?
No, I was actually trying to leave the track.
Right.
I just decided to have a go at this experiment. I think I was feeling fearless and it was quite an unusual thing to do. There have been actually a few of these films after it, but I really liked multi-story movies and thought it would be fun to do.
Did you start with Hugh? Was he already signed up? Did you say, look, I've got another film on the way... It's worked well.
No, I started with the idea of the 10 films, and I already had a few of them in my mind.
Aren't there 10
and one of them,
in
I think
Love
so.
Actually?
Yeah, I think so.
So that is like
maybe
Shortcuts, isn't it? That's the old one.
Yeah.
Was
and,
that
and
an
I love. Oh, yeah, I loved Shortcuts, and I loved... Nashville was one of the movies I really adored when I was young. I don't know why. I think it's the fact that for the movie-going experience, and, you know, Pulp Fiction has whatever it does, 3 or 4.
Yeah.
I love that idea of jumping. And, in fact, even movies like Those Magnificent Men and their flying machines and stuff like that, where you jump from plot to plot, I thought was fun. Yeah, so very rarely have I written for people. Notting Hill very specifically was not written for Hugh, but then we auditioned about 5 other people and thought, oh, God.
Did you have somebody else in mind?
No, it was the whole point of Notting Hill was it was going to be someone not famous.
Oh.
The idea of having a completely new person.
And then somebody playing a very famous person.
And then Julia Roberts. So as it were, you know, it was meant to be in our new film.
Yeah,
Himesh
yeah.
Patel is playing the hero who people who haven't watched EastEnders don't know. And I love that fact that that you've got an unknown playing someone who becomes incredibly famous. But, yeah, so, no, I was actually... I had a problem with my back and I couldn't write for a while and I spent 6 months thinking of tales to tell rather than, which I would normally do, starting to write a whole film.
Ah, so it's a film that was born out of recuperation.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's interesting. Is it, there's a, and the immediate thing that springs to mind is Ringo, as a kid, was laid up in bed and learnt to play the drums by kind of tapping his way across his... Yeah, on pots and pans, because he had nothing else to do.
Well, there are that other was the examples. Only thing I could do is think of more stories than usual. And there are about five, you know, or six. There are all sorts of ones that haven't made it and didn't make it into the film, including a couple we actually shot.
Did you... I mean, given that you didn't want Hugh Grant in... specifically for Notting Hill,
yeah,
and then you relented, and he was back. Was he immediately your prime minister?
Yeah, I just thought that would be funny. You know, I was just trying to think of a gimmick, really, and I think I knew that I wanted Emma Thompson to play the part that she played because it had a particular focus, and I'd had such a good experience with her on The Tall Guy. But apart from that, it was an absolute mother to cast, because you were looking for 22. Leads. So, I mean, it was a huge job, but a joyful job, because you were giving lots of very good actors a chunky thing, but they didn't have to, you know, give up their whole summer, as it were.
But there is a kind of Richard Curtis ensemble now, isn't there? Or a repertory company of people who have returned to the films.
Yeah, and I hope it's because they're the right people in each case. I mean, the Bill Nye story in this one is interesting, because I had two people in mind, both of whom were very famous already. And
what does Bill play? Remind us.
He plays a rock and roll star. And I think one of them was a rock and roll star and the other one was a very famous comedian. And we hadn't asked either of them. And I said to Mary Selway, who was casting it, bring along someone for the read-through who will do it well. And she said, well, what about Bill Nye? And I said, he'd be perfect, because I know I don't like him as an actor. And so no matter how good he is, he won't get the role, so I don't have to feel sort of bad about it. And then he was so good at the read-through that he got the part.
Did you not?
And seriously? Then I just kept on casting him in different ways.
But up to that point, you actually didn't
Seen him in a couple of, you know, slightly annoying left-wing plays and decided he was not for me.
Where did it go from there, then? Given that you've got 10 stories and you have to start then interweaving them.
Yeah.
Because they do intercut. It's not one of those kind of portmanteau films where it is back-to-back and one story stops and the next one starts, you know, some kind of French way.
Yeah. No. It was a lot of fun to write, because what I was basically saying, I was going to write the first scene, the middle scene, as it were, just take the best scenes of different movies and put them all in the same film. And it took a long time to do, and I tried all sorts of other methods. I tried there was a narrator going to go through it. I remember at some point it started with a bunch of people, rather like maybe Broadway Danny Rose, all sort of saying what's the sort of love story that's most hurt your feelings or that you know about, and I didn't do that. And I decided to set it at Christmas, about halfway through the process, because I suddenly thought, how am I going to accelerate everybody towards a sense of crunch time and the same deadline? Because Christmas does do that a bit. Mm. And then I finished writing the film. We went through this epic casting thing, had the most amazing read-through, because they are, you know, that's quite a shock when you actually hear the film, and it really seemed to work. And then, you know, the real story of love actually is I can talk to you a bit about shooting it, which was very complicated, but when we put the film together, it didn't work at all. It turned out that on screen, all the things that had worked in a room when you could see 20 people and think, oh, we'll be back to Liam soon, or we'll be back to Kira soon, that there was just a completely different story unfolded. So it was an agonizing edit. I mean, I really thought the film was not going to work for month after month after month, because I couldn't keep the tension up, I couldn't keep the story going, I couldn't get the rhythms right.
And given that that was the first one that you directed,
yeah,
was that you learning on the job? Would you have done it differently in retrospect, given you know what...
I don't think I would have known. And the reason I've not done a sequel to Love Actually, or even done another film in that genre, is because I think we got through it by the skin of our teeth, and I don't want to risk it again, because there may have been lessons to be learned. But I don't know. I just think that, you know, my theory of editing a movie is that it's like, or the kind of movies I do, is that it's like pulling someone on a rope towards you. And if you change the tone too much or go in a direction that they don't want, or, you know, then that's like cutting the rope and you've got to go all the way back, right, pick it up again and pull the person again. I'm very sort of aware of that feeling of hanging on, giving people the next scene that they want, holding on to the emotions, not being inconsistent, suddenly someone behaving in a strange way. And I think what happened in Love Actually is I was just endlessly cutting the rope because you're just getting interested in the story. And then you give them another bit of another story from another perspective at another point.
And ending up with a film which is the sort of antithesis of what you do, which is wanting people to go on the journey with you rather than confronting them or having that jarring thing that many filmmakers would relish.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's interesting you said. I haven't really sort of thought about that. I once had a big disagreement with Anthony Minghella about, he said that he never considered the audience. He wrote the story for himself, whatever he wanted to happen next to the characters. And I don't write, as it were, a story to please the audience. But on the other hand, the whole point is to pull in the person sitting around the fire listening to your tale.
Do you believe Anthony when he said that?
I didn't believe him.
No. Well, you didn't believe he meant that?
No, I didn't believe he... I'm sure he meant it. Yeah. But I seem to remember there was like some example of there's a scene, isn't there a scene in The English Patient where someone gets up and hits their head? They've been hiding behind something. And I just said to him, you must have known that that was going to make the audience laugh and therefore put them off their guard and therefore allow you to do something in the next scene, rather than you thinking what would happen at this point in these people's relationship. One of them would hit their head. It didn't make sense to me. So, I mean, look, we all, make things and then sort of post-explain them.
So it was a real struggle, Love Actually.
I mean, the shoot was... Look, I can't tell every tale now. The shoot was tough because... I mean, it was good because nobody could see how unready I was for the task because they all only stayed on for 2 weeks. You know, it was a strange old thing. They hardly met each other.
The whole shoot was 2 weeks?
No, each person, each actor. Right. That was the thing. You know, I didn't have 10 weeks to establish trust or, of course, lose trust. It was a weird thing. It was like making 10 films, 10 different locations, 10 different stars and partners and everything like that. So the shoot was, hard. And the fact that it's worked at all, I mean, every time anyone says that they've watched it and enjoyed it, I breathe a sigh of relief.
Do you enjoy watching? Do you re-watch your films?
No, I don't really. But I have seen that one recently because a friend of ours did a screening at Drury Lane Theatre with a live orchestra. And I said I'd introduce it and watch it because I haven't seen the film since with a audience, you don't see it after the premiere. So you've had this wonderful experience of, 1,000 friends watching a movie, and then any other time you see it is never going to be feel like that. And also, when you've made movies, they turn into... while you're editing a movie, you hang on to not knowing the story. You have to literally say, oh, my God, here's a girl called Bridget. So when you make a film, you have to hang on to sort of... innocence. You mustn't know that the guy is going to meet the girl and everything like that. You've got to empty your brain. And then the moment the stress of the edit is gone, it just melts and it becomes a very expensive diary. I just think, oh, God, she didn't want to wear that costume and he was in a bad mood and it rained and all that kind of stuff.
You never went into cinemas, paid and put a baseball cap on and sat at the back?
I've done it a couple of times, but it's always a disaster. Because it's always a disaster. Because, look, you go in and you think, oh, it's Thursday, the movie's doing well. I remember going to see Four Weddings and even Bean, but I've learnt my lesson now. And there's always just 11 people in there and they don't laugh for the first 48 minutes. So, no, that would be a mistake.
So at Christmas time, Four Weddings comes on, or Love Actually, or whatever, it comes onto the television, do you just never sit down and
go? No, I don't watch them.
Are you proud of Love Actually? Given that it was such a struggle, given it was your first directorial...
When I saw it the other day, when I saw this one, I thought, what a perky film. I mean, there are a couple of things in it which are based on things in my life that are sadder, and I do notice those, but... It does feel like, as it were, a young man's film, and I'm glad I had the joy and the energy and the hope to make that film. Yeah, I'm happy. It makes people happy.
Do you have any plans to make films about love at an older age?
I don't have, at the moment, plans to make any more films, so the answer is probably No. I mean, I did make ECO Trot, which was this film with Dustin Hoffman and Judi Dench. And I'd always wanted to make a movie about my mum and dad. And they're quite like my mum and dad, those two. Blonde and dark. Very, I mean, my mum was very Australian. My dad was from Czechoslovakia. So there's a, that's in a way, I think, my version of that film.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
So let's move on to the film I wish I'd made.
Okay.
Are you a big film fan? Are you one of those people that has to... Do you have an encyclopedic knowledge of cinema?
No, I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of cinema. I've never seen a movie by Fellini. I saw a couple of Bergmans early on.
I've never seen a Fellini?
No. I've seen one movie by Kurosawa. I've never seen a movie by Pasolini. You know, I mean, I'm not a big film fan, but I'm a great fan of popular films and going to the movies, and I absolutely love doing that, and I've seen lots and lots and lots of films. And so the film I'm going to pick, the films I was toying between choosing were a film called The Sun's Room, which actually won at Cannes and is the most extraordinary movie by Nanni Moretti about a man and his wife whose son dies at the age of 15. And it's completely realistic, completely low-key, and the most extraordinary analysis of sorrow. And the strange thing is I can't recommend it because it's also a sad experience, and I don't think anyone else in my family has seen it yet. But that... It would have been marvellous for me if I'd had, as it were, the nerve or the inspiration to make a low-key, realistic movie. And Moretti is a very famous comedian in Italy. So, yeah. But I'm not going to talk about that one. And I won't talk about sort of the inspiration films of my youth, The Breaking Aways and Gregory's Girl. I think I'll talk about this film called 500 Days of Summer, which was made, I think, 10 years ago. Just because if I'd thought of it, God, I would have made it. And it gives me complete delight. And it's like a quintessential version of the kind of thing I might have been able to do.
It's a coming-of-age movie.
It's a love story. I mean, it's probably dangerously close in a way to Annie Hall, in that it's a sort of love story, a sort of messy love story in sketch format. But what is brilliant about it is that it plays about with time even more than Annie Hall. So these 500 right. days, going from day one to 500, I think it starts at day 184, then goes back to day 3, then goes forward to day 400, then back to 78. So it really messes with this love story, knowing how love stories go, as it were, you know, that they're going to start not knowing each other, then meeting each other, then falling in love, then something's going to go wrong.
It plays with the linear thing,
messes with the linear thing. It stars Zooey Deschanel, John Oh, God alive. Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's adorable in it. And Zoe, who's adorable, you know, just such a sort of mysterious and beautiful actress.
And she plays Summer.
She plays Summer. And she's a very, you know, in a way, like Diane Keaton was, like some great, you know, characters in romantic movies. She's really interesting. She's complicated. She's sort of unknowable. He's a bit of a sort of normal duffer like the leads in my movies have been. It's got so many jokes in it. It's got so many jokes in it. And so many unexpected scenes when things go worse than they should. And it's all broken up. So it's got like the definitive resignation scene by him. He works in a card company and, you know, greetings card company. And there's a great scene when he resigns. There's a great karaoke scene. There's a very famous scene, which is so beautiful, where he meets her again at a wedding, and you think, oh, it's all going to be fine. And she invites him to a party, and the whole party is done with what he hoped was going to happen and what actually did happen. So the screen is split.
Parallel narratives.
Screen is split in two.
Yeah.
And it starts the same, and she kisses him exactly the same at the start of both, but then in one she introduces him to her fiancé, and in the other one what actually happens is so... It's that. And it's got, you know, an amazing little song and dance number. So it's this absolute full bag of tricks.
It sounds like a Richard Curtis movie in many ways.
Well, your question was a film you'd wish you'd made. I mean, yeah. Obviously, I wish I'd made Raging Bull or something like that. But we you know.
So you're recognizing something of yourself in that movie.
I'm recognizing a definitive version of the kind of film that I could have made. And then when I'm, you know, a movie like The Sun's Room or Lucas Moodysson's Lilia Forever, these are movies I could never make, but wouldn't it have been great if I could?
"500 Days of Summer", I'm heading to that. So, the film I'm making, and you just told me a moment ago that you're not making a film and you have no plans to make any more films.
Yeah.
I mean, partly because you have just made a film, which we will talk about, we'll bend the rules of this podcast, but also, I guess, because you are so busy with all the other work.
Yeah, I do lots of other work. Also, I mean, look, I bet I changed my mind. That's the thing. So I want to preface this by saying I am definitely lying. But in theory, at the moment, I feel as though I've now made two films about prioritizing your life over your work. And if you have the luxury of being able to do that, particularly when you've got lots of kids, and like me, you have never watched a movie by Fellini, never read a book over 300 pages long, never learned to cook, never walked around Scotland, I'm just wondering whether or not it would be wrong for me to dive in. And particularly, you know, when I'm not going to make Lilia Forever, particularly when I'm not going to make The Sun's Room, when I'm not going to make, you know, the things I do are going to be familiar, and they're probably going to be familiar to me.
And there's no regret about that. You don't think, oh, God, why didn't I make those sort of movies? Why didn't I?
Well, no, another reason, oddly enough, but also there are lots of things I thought I was going to make that I never did. I've got four or five. I've got one particular sitcom. I've got three or four other films, and I never got around to doing. And you can't do it all.
So this is a probable hiatus, but not the Richard Curtis retirement.
No, I suppose not. No, it would be ridiculous to think that was going to happen. But I want to. I want to take advice of About Time and focus on the everyday. And the new movie that I've just done, we can break the rules.
Let's break the rules. Because actually, do you know what? Officially, you've just told me that you were heading to the premiere.
Yes, so I'm still making
it. So the film
I was Baz Luhrmann, I'd still be changing it.
You would run from the premiere, head straight to the edit suite and say, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
So this is a film called Yesterday. Young man is hit by a bus on his bike, wakes up, and the world has changed, and the key change to the world is nobody knows who the Beatles are.
Yeah.
Apart from him.
Yeah. He's in a good situation that he can play a guitar. And if that happened to me, I would have to commit suicide because I couldn't play a note. But yeah, he knows how to play, and he's sort of You know, he writes Let It Be. He writes The Long and Winding Road. He writes Help. And the film is, you know, I hope as funny as it can be, but and it also bends towards looking at, you know, how we all feel like imposters, and it also looks at the thing I'm almost most interested in, which is what do you choose? Do you choose work, which I sometimes think I've overchosen, or do you choose love? And in this case, it's love with Lily James, which would be a very bad mistake to turn your back on.
But the concept itself, and you mentioned that key scene from which the film takes its title, when he sits down with a group of friends and he's recovering from the accident, and Lily James, Ellie, hands him a present, a new guitar, and he just plays Yesterday. An astonishing moment, I thought. I knew the premise of the film, and I thought, well, that sounds a bit silly. And that moment was a real revelation, because you hear that song in a totally fresh way. And I guess that's the point, isn't it? That these songs stand the test of time. You strip them down, they're unbreakable.
Yeah, it's funny how I did wonder as I set off on the journey, I wondered whether or not I would end up thinking that the Beatles would not be as huge. Now, they wouldn't be as huge because there was this astonishing, joyful magic in Four Boys and Four Haircuts from Liverpool with those accents, with those jokes, with that friendship. But the more I've listened to the songs, and they're really stripped down in the movie, the more I think, oh no, this is, you know, Monet or Picasso or Mozart or whatever that. These are utterly magical tunes with an utterly magical relationship with their lyrics. I mean, I often have become more and more interested in the lyrics. All the way through, there are just amazing lines that come out. And I think, imagine if the Beatles were starting now and they were called The Bottles, and they did what Ed Sheeran's doing with his new album, which is releasing a single every 2 weeks. I mean, if one of those songs came out every 2 weeks, which they could have done for 5 years, no one would be able to risk that barrage of sort of joyful genius, I don't think.
No, they stand up today, yeah. Don't they? They absolutely do stand up. You mentioned Ed Sheeran, who has a really interesting cameo role. He is Ed Sheeran, and he is the superstar, but then he becomes Salieri to the Mozart character played by Himesh Patel.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a very self-deprecating way of playing it, I thought.
Yeah, no, I mean, Ed was fun, because in a way the movie's about Ed, because Ed, you know, started in Suffolk where the movie's set, and then he, you know, as it were, went round the world, captured the world, and he's come home to marry a girl he knew at school. So that gave me the confidence that things can work out in that way. And then, yeah, he's actually playing himself in the movie and really acting rather well. I think one of the things, you know, it's been a joy in this because I've been working with Danny Boyle on it. And Danny's does some very intelligent things, and he created a very relaxed environment for Ed. And Ed's surrounded in many of the scenes by the friends he's surrounded by actually on tour. Ah. His entourage are there.
That is so, his crew that we see.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a proper and friendly environment. And also, you know, the scene you were just talking about, the Yesterday scene, I was sort of startled that he chose to do that one so simply. You know, I thought, oh, maybe he'll do some fireworks here, but he knew just at that moment to take it right down when they sing Yesterday, because he does some fireworks elsewhere in the movie. There are scenes where I would have had, you know, two shots and Danny's got 102 shots. But how clever it was to simply say, look, either this song is going to be magical or the film doesn't work, and he trusted the song.
What's interesting is that given that this is a collaboration, you've written the film and Danny Boyle has directed it. If I didn't know and I saw this film, I would say, yeah, it's a Richard Curtis film. It's not obviously a Danny Boyle film, is it?
Well, of course, I see it as much more so because I know what I wouldn't be able to do.
Right.
So, you know, when he gets hit by the bike, I know the Richard Curtis version of that scene. There's a bike, there's a bus, cut to shocked bystander and sound of a bang off screen. But with Danny, there's a shot of the world and the electricity and slow motion and lights going out everywhere. So I kind of see that, and I see how he's kept it. And I think he's like a perfect choice because he's very good on sort of reality and realism, but also on just giving things a tiny spin, which makes you feel always the world's not quite where it's meant to be. But also Danny's he's done a lot of different kinds of films. In a way, he's remembered for most for Trainspotting and Slumdog. These are two very different films. They're fast moving, but wow, their emotional focus is different. So this is Danny Boyle's romantic film at the moment, and I think he's, you know, well, I love the way he's done it.
What struck me walking into your house today, the first thing I saw on the wall with pictures of the Beatles.
Yes.
There are those fantastic... well, there's the Don McCullen one, isn't there? There's the... was it Avedon did that?
You haven't been upstairs, by the way.
Really? Yeah. There's more up there. A shrine to the Beatles. Yeah. So you genuinely love the Beatles.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously my, you know, whole, you know, job in life has been... You know, I'm not... I don't consider myself either much cleverer or funnier than anyone else, but I did have the confidence to try and reproduce the jokes and things I'm interested in for real. And so that was, like, right from the start, Roman and I, when we joined Not the Nikon News, there was a tendency to sort of do satirical things and jokes about, you know, whatever was in the news at the moment. And we drifted off very quickly into sort of our own slightly peculiar world of jokes that we were enjoying at that time. And I've always stuck to that, and therefore, you know, I don't make films about things that I don't really, really, really feel very deeply. So I feel the Beatles thing every day of my life. I genuinely think that those sort of, that combination of joy and love, and even when you're being sad, wrap it up like Help in something bouncy, you know, has been the inspiration of everything I do. So I wouldn't have done this movie about the monkeys, let's put it that way.
And anybody who's dealt with the Beatles as a sort of corporate empire and Apple and all of those things and the legacy knows it's complicated. Yeah. How you had to obviously get sign off and consent to use the songs, I guess. Was it?
I think there were. I think it is complicated. I actually admire that complication. I think that, you know, the Beatles have their legacy to protect, and certainly not up to them. You know, they've done everything they need to do to endorse anything. So they're very careful. We got on the right side of the careful, and it, you know, it took work. But I think, you know, if it had been, you know, here's a Beatles-based movie saying how enthusiastic, you know, the serial killer Ted Bundy was about the Beatles, I think they probably would have said no, but we were, you know, it's quite a gentle conceit.
Has McCartney seen it?
McCartney hasn't seen it, no. But I hope I'll see it, and I hope I like it.
Richard, thanks very much. Great to
see you.
Thank
you very much indeed.
Please do rate and review these three. It helps other people find the series. And subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. Also, have a look at the website. We've got more information about all of the guests. There are photographs, videos, previews of forthcoming episodes. We're on Twitter and Instagram, of course. These Three is produced and presented by me, John Wilson, in association with Analog Folk. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about...
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.